This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, trash dumps, which may contaminate groundwater, are being closed in Massachusetts and Georgia. Can recycling take care of the excess? We meet a scientist who is trying to find an organism to eat brown algae before the algae killed scallops and shellfish. Environment Show advisors reflect on 1997. How do we make policy when science is unclear? Pacific salmon may go extinct, while other wildlife are too numerous. What to do? In the Earth Calendar, we participate in the 97th annual Christmas Bird Count. It's the Environment Show. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. For years, communities across the United States have dumped trash into unlined landfills. The landfills are a source of groundwater contamination, which is a serious concern in communities which rely on well water. Now, state environmental officials recognize the dangers of unlined dump sites, and the Environment Show's Rachel Phillips looks at how two states are trying to get rid of them.
The good news is that states are starting to close unlined landfills. The bad news, however, is that many landfills have been operating without synthetic liners and leachate collection systems that stop contaminants from entering groundwater supplies. While newer landfills include liner systems, the garbage in the old unlined fills produces leachate and contaminants that can seep into the groundwater for years to come. Over the past 4 years, Massachusetts has closed or designated for closure 98 of the 105 unlined landfills in the state. The remaining unlined dump sites will be closed by the year 2000. State officials say increasing recycling rates from 33% to 46% by the end of the decade is key to dealing with the additional waste. Scott Cassell, Director of Waste Policy for the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Affairs, says technical assistance is just one way the state is encouraging municipalities to increase recycling.
We also have in our toolbox the stick approach, which is having minimum recycling programs required for each community so that their recyclables, the trucks that would come from those communities would not be inspected at disposal facilities. Right now in Massachusetts, we do have a policy of requires trucks from municipalities that do not meet minimum recycling requirements to be inspected at disposal facilities.
Cassell says residents are also being encouraged to take a more active role in the recycling process. Officials say the pay-per-bag or pay-as-you-throw plan is the most important part of the state's plan. It requires residents to pay for the amount of garbage they put on the curb. The theory is that residents are more likely to recycle if they know they're saving money. Overall, Cassell says recycling is more popular today, not only because of the positive environmental effects, but because it's created 12,000 new jobs in Massachusetts, which helps the economy. Like Massachusetts, Georgia is also in the process of closing unlined landfills. Approximately 43 such sites are expected to be closed by July 1st. Jim Dunbar, program manager of the Solid Waste Program of Georgia's Environmental Protection Division, says the state has had two cases of low-level contamination in residential water wells located near unlined landfills.
In Georgia, we didn't start permitting, and they were not constructed lined landfills until the late 80s. And all of those landfills that were permitted and built before the late 80s are unlined. And they are the unlined landfills are much less protective of the groundwater than the lined landfills. We have water monitoring data from the unlined landfills that we have in the state, and some of those are contaminating groundwater monitoring wells around the sites.
Dunbar says no groundwater contamination has been reported near the state's lined landfills. Lehman Scott, director of waste management with Georgia's Department of Community Affairs, says Georgia has enough lined landfills to handle the state's waste for years to come. Nonetheless, state officials are helping to improve recycling efforts at the local level, which slows the rate at which trash is put underground. Scott says a number of programs are being offered to localities.
We do a lot of planning assistance and technical assistance. We do assist local governments with starting programs, with enhancing existing programs. We also help them find markets for the materials that they'll be collecting. And we maintain an active or a current directory of recycling markets in the state. Where can you take your glass? Where can you take your plastic? Based on where you're located within the state of Georgia. We also do a lot of information and contact sharing and case studies with these local governments.
Georgia is also offering training programs for local recycling coordinators, as well as implementing its own pay-as-you-throw system. Currently, about 32% of the waste material produced in Georgia is recycled, a figure state officials hope will increase without placing mandates on localities. While officials have not set a recycling rate goal, they are hoping these volunteer programs will be successful and subsequently improve recycling across the state. However, such programs often need adequate funding in order to be effective. Georgia State Legislature provided $5 million to help increase recycling efforts in the state, which isn't much considering the state's size. But Lehman Scott remains optimistic.
I think it will make a difference. I don't know if the numbers of percent recycling rate will bear it out, but I think some of the programs that we have invested in are very positive, and I think it will make a difference on the local level as to the availability of recycling and waste reduction efforts, and to the knowledge that the average citizen has about waste issues. That's part of our overall program is public education.
Scott says 1997 was the first time a significant amount of money was spent on recycling, but admits he doesn't expect Georgia's legislators to include additional funding for recycling programs in the next fiscal year. For The Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
As we recently reported on The Environment Show, red tides in the oceans caused by algae have been around for millions of years. While most algal blooms are relatively harmless, a few dozen are toxic and can kill marine life as well as humans. A little over a decade ago, a new algae appeared in the sea. It's brown. This brown tide is severely impacting both marine environments in the Northeast and many people who depend on the ocean. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on one scientist's search for answers.
The alga, recently causing problems along the northeastern Atlantic coastline, is known as Oreococcus anaphagefrans.
That organism is a cause of a problem called brown tides. That's typically where you hear it referred to. The brown algae is a very wide, large group of algae, contains many, many species. This particular one is an organism that has actually caused tremendous problems since 1985. They had a massive bloom in the inshore waters of Long Island and also in a significant part of Narragansett Bay. Since then, they've had recurring brown tides, not every year, but frequently, in bays of Long Island, specifically the Peconic Bay system, which is a large bay system in the eastern part of the island, and the Great South Bay system, Shinnecock Mauritius Bay, which is most of the southern lagoonal systems.
That's Dr. David Caron, senior scientist in the biology department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod. Oreococcus anaphagefrans in essence means small golden cell, causing organisms to stop feeding. Mussels and scallops obtain food by filtering ocean water. Oreococcus enters the shellfish and in high concentrations can prohibit them from feeding, which starves the animals to death. The alga has the ability to multiply rapidly, reaching levels of a million or so in very small amounts of water, according to Dr. Caron.
Now, when it does that, it actually has the effect of blocking out a lot of the sun. This Oreococcus itself actually does have the ability to grow fairly well at very low light conditions, which means it can make the water turbid, and it can still do fairly well. Unfortunately, for things like eelgrass at the bottom, it's the kiss of death. It actually cuts out enough of the light at high abundances of this little brown tide organism that it shades the organisms on the bottom, particularly eelgrass, and basically prevents it from being able to photosynthesize and grow. When it dies, it actually is, the eelgrass is a habitat for things such as scallops. So when their habitat goes, essentially they go.
While there were some smaller blooms this past year, the two largest blooms occurred in 1985, when the alga first bloomed, and in 1995. During those years, Long Island scallop fishers lost millions of dollars, not to mention the effects on tourism, recreation, and real estate. A number of theories have been suggested as to the cause of brown tide. Some speculate it's due to pesticides, fertilizers, industrial waste, or a combination of everything man is putting into the waterways. Karen says increasing levels of nitrogen and phosphorus, also known as nutrient enrichment, has something to do with the blooms. But he says there's more to it than that. Karen believes the answer lies in the relationships between the various phytoplankton.
In order to get them to grow and form a bloom, they have to actually be enriched. They have to be growing. But in order for them to reach bloom proportions, in order for their abundances to increase, they essentially can't be removed from the system. In other words, we feel that it is the predator-prey relationships in the water that have a large part to do with who wins the competition. Because if you have two organisms that are growing very rapidly, then only one of them, if only one of them is predated on and the other is not, that one that is predated on will not build up to high concentrations.
Karen has also theorized that the overfishing of shellfish is contributing to brown tides. Since fewer scallops and mussels are there to filter the water, there may be an overabundance of some microorganisms, like Oreococcus, which can outcompete others under the right conditions. There is also some question as to whether Oreococcus was native to the northeastern coastline or whether it came from somewhere else. Besides understanding why such blooms are occurring, Dr. Karen is also trying to determine whether other organisms can help stop brown tides after they begin.
We call them enrichment cultures. What we're doing is we're providing the food for the predators that we want to see grow up in that system. So we have cultures of the brown tide alga in the laboratory, and we add cultures of this organism to these water samples until the natural predators in the system grow up, until they increase their population abundances. Then under the microscope, we actually go in and we pick out individual organisms and we grow them as cultures. We then, from then on, we have a pure culture of this organism. And what we have been doing lately in the laboratory is to run tests to find out if once those cultures are grown, they can continue to grow rapidly on the brown tide organism. And in fact, in doing that, we've found a number of organisms that are capable, at least in the laboratory, of consuming this alga at very rapid rates.
So far, three predators have been identified as possible contenders of the brown alga, but testing these predator-prey relationships in a laboratory and in the field are two different things, which Dr. Karen continues to research. But in general, he believes a lot of progress has been made in understanding brown tides in a very short amount of time. Karen emphasizes while there is a greater awareness of the impacts man is having on marine environments, better management is needed, especially in the areas of land use and ocean dumping. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. The Environment Show wants to hear from you. Give us a call. Our phone number is 1-888-49-GREEN. You can also reach us by email at green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The show has a distinguished board of advisors who share counsel, wisdom, and contacts with us throughout the year. Annually, as the new year begins, we ask them to assess what has happened and what lies ahead. Advisory Council member Brewster Denny is professor and former dean of the School of Public Administration at the University of Washington in Seattle. He's concerned about environmental policy and the role of science.
Well, I think the big thing we face is the number of basic issues, not only environmental, but all with a heavy environmental content, that are very science-dependent in nature. That is, judgments have to be made now about things and actions taken now about things that science predicts, not always with great certainty, will be real problems in the future if we don't do something now.
Close to home, Seattle resident Denny believes the future of the king salmon is a big issue.
I sit here on the banks of the Pacific Ocean, and we are about to lose, we will lose, the great salmon. They're on their way out. They are becoming extinct. They will shortly one the prime species of salmon, the one we call king, will likely be gone and be certainly soon be declared as a endangered species. And it takes a lot of guts to deal with it. We have a new fisheries director in the state of Washington who has real courage. He says, well, we may have to stop fishing. We certainly have to stop farm fishing if we can. We have to stop it all over the world in order to save our fish. And we'll have to greatly reduce hatcheries, the dependence on hatchery fisheries, if we're going to save these great wild salmon runs, which are, you know, one of the most wonderful things the Lord ever gave us.
Brewster Denny is professor and former dean of the School of Public Administration at the University of Washington. Advisory Council member Mike Robbins, former editor of Audubon Magazine, is also concerned about human activity and wildlife, but from a different perspective. Specifically, how we share space with wildlife species that are increasing, such as bison, coyotes, white-tailed deer, and snow geese.
One of the things that struck me as being of major importance to environmentalists was the issue of wild nature and really coming up as an issue of how we're going to live with it. I'm thinking of the situation in Yellowstone last winter when a surfeit of bison in the wrong place for the bison, and as it turned out, wrong place for the ranchers, resulted in over 1,000 bison being slaughtered, much to the dismay not only of the bison, but of environmentalists and nature lovers everywhere, I think. That's a situation that points up a larger situation in my mind that emerged last year, which is a kind of imbalance in our terms of wildlife. We've long, I think, wrestled with the idea of the threats to endangered species and so on, and haven't given much thought to the issue of what happens if we succeed.
So where does this take us, Mike?
Well, here we are,
the critters are coming back, and now we can't handle them.
Well, that's the
issue. Now what do we do?
Now what do we do indeed? We've got to develop some solutions that do not rest, in my view, that do not rest on traditional means of reducing the numbers, which largely come down to shooting them. That is to say, you know, either allowing hunting seasons to be lengthened, or the numbers of animals that can be taken increased. I don't think the public, the number of hunters, the percentage of the population that's engaging in hunting is declining. And in my view, I think part of the collision here is that the public support for hunting is declining. And I think there's going to be increasing pressure. I think we saw this for the first time in 1997 with another animal, the snow goose. where there's going to be increasing pressure for a solution other than simply, you know, blasting them out of the sky.
That was Environment Show advisor Mike Robbins, former editor of Audubon Magazine. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. In the last couple of weeks, about 42,000 Americans took part in approximately 1,700 bird counts around the United States. This year marked the 97th consecutive annual Christmas bird count, which is organized by the National Audubon Society. One count was held along the Hudson River near Constitution Marsh Sanctuary, located about an hour north of New York City. National Audubon operates the sanctuary, and Jim Rodd is the manager.
At the end of the day, we tallied with all the groups in the field, and it turned out there were about 40 of us out in that 15-mile circle. We tallied a total of 73 species, and that was low. Our average is 79, and our high, which actually was last year, was 82 species. And we think it was the warm weather, frankly. As you know, there was no snow cover at all, which meant that food supplies were really abundant. So birds did not flock into food sources, and with no snow on the ground, some of the smaller things are harder to see. We had good numbers of ducks, a lot of ruddy ducks, a lot of hooded mergansers, a lot of mallards and black ducks, because so much of the water was open. But other birds were down. In fact, the bald eagle that we saw at Constitution Marsh that morning was the only one seen by any of the groups that day.
Rod attributes the few sightings of bald eagles to warm temperatures. He believes the eagles will migrate south as rivers and lakes in the Adirondacks freeze as the winter progresses. Meantime, Rod says there are plenty of other species which stay around for the colder months.
It always surprises people when these lists are published to learn that numbers of bluebirds and robins stick around this area in the wintertime. And we had, I think, 43 bluebirds altogether, some in our area, but pretty well scattered out through the other areas as well. And quite a few robins. Robins are considered half-hardy, which means many of them will stick around in the wintertime. And often the first robins people see in the spring aren't really new migrants. They're birds that have been here all winter. And as long as they can find berries and a little bit of open water to drink, they'll stick around. We did not have numbers of the so-called winter finches. We had no evening grosbeaks. We had no pine grosbeaks. But there were a lot of redpolls that came down. I think we had nearly 400 redpolls. And this is supposed to be a year of invading winter finches. But they haven't come in any numbers to Putnam County, at least yet. Again, probably a function of the warm winter weather that's reaching clear up into Canada.
Hermit thrushes, Carolina wrens, cardinals, as well as hairy and downy woodpeckers were also spotted along the Hudson River. Audubon's Christmas bird count began in 1900 when ornithologist Frank Chapman decided to see how many birds could be counted on Christmas Day as an alternative to the custom of shooting as many birds as possible on that day. Records of all the counts are on file in the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Counting parties gather in groups and cover a 15-mile diameter circle. Again, Jim Rodd.
But the Audubon Christmas bird count is really the largest citizen science participation project that goes on anywhere in the country, or anywhere in the world for that matter. And the value of the information we get from the Christmas counts comes in the fact that they have gone on for so long. The first counts began in 1900, so for 97 years, in some areas of the country, people have been gathering systematic data. They go out on essentially the same date each winter, cover exactly the same ground. And as we get years and decades of information, we can see population trends in many birds. One year taken by itself means nothing statistically. Now, my wife, in fact, is a statistics professor, and she's taught me that you need many years of data. But on these Christmas counts, many of them have taken place for over 50 years in the same area, and we have terrific information. We can see fluctuations in wintering waterfowl numbers, bald eagles, and virtually any other species.
Rod says counts even occur in metropolitan areas, such as the Bronx in New York City, where avid birders gather to tally the various species. It's still unclear whether these bird watchers spotted any strange birds, which are sometimes found in urban areas. Strange birds are tough to see, though. They come in various sizes and shapes. They lack feathers, and who knows, they may be us. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, an expanding world market for lumber is putting new pressure on Mexican forests. In the second of a series, we hear from Mexicans who say a lot of what is happening is outside the law. We talk green about private property, community rights, and environmental protection. And author David Nolan takes us for a riverboat ride in Borneo. Stay with us. Recently, Mexico announced that it is launching a $385 million tourism project to attract people to an 8,000-square-mile forest area near Chihuahua. Environmentalists fear that the construction of roads and lodges will severely disrupt the wooded area and the lifestyle of a 6,000-year-old tribe. But the bigger threat to Mexican forests is trade in logs and lumber. Restrictions in U.S. forests are causing some lumber companies to go to Mexico for wood, with many trees being harvested illegally. In this report, Kent Patterson examines some regulatory issues that have grown out of the expanding Mexican lumber trade.
At the Santa Teresa border crossing in southern New Mexico, a forklift moves lumber back onto a truck. In the last 2 years, lumber shipments from Mexico have become an important commodity here. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, shipments in 1997 were running more than double 1996 figure, increasing to more than 20,500,000 board feet. Sharon O'Neill is a public affairs officer with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, APHIS.
Okay, what you're looking at here is rough cut pine lumber. Okay, you can still see some of the bark on it. See the bark up there? And these are not cut to dimension. Rough cut means that this lumber will go to a U.S. mill and be finished. Okay, then it'll turn into real boards.
The wood passing through Santa Teresa is sold as moldings or firewood in places such as Colorado, where a $25 cord of wood can reportedly fetch more than $200. According to Sharon O'Neill, changing political and economic circumstances are behind the trade.
We never traditionally imported lumber into the United States from foreign sources. And when we did, it was through Canada. So Canadian stuff was about the same as our own stuff. However, we've had certain issues that happened since 1990. One is the environmental issues that are occurring in the Pacific Northwest, and also the issue of who's going to log U.S. public lands. Are we going to leave them alone? Are we going to harvest the resources? What are we going to do? That has kind of put a lot of stops onto domestic lumber production. So therefore, other lumber, in order to maintain our mills and Our domestic production is actually being augmented by foreign imports.
Still, the trade cuts both ways. U.S. wood and paper exports to Mexico actually grew during this period. For instance, according to the Global Trade Information Service, the value of these exports leaped from $487 million in 1993 to $557 million in 1995. And in some cases, raw wood from the U.S. is shipped to Mexico to be processed and then sent back as a finished product. Specific products are finding their own niches in an increasingly integrated economy. Maria Teresa Guerrero is an organizer with the Chihuahua Commission in Solidarity and Defense of Human Rights, a nonprofit group active around environmental and indigenous issues.
Nosotros sabemos que la industria papelera es una industria muy importante. Digo,
we know that the paper industry is a very important industry. Everything we do is with paper. We write and read with paper. We need to tackle the problem of paper production in terms of the conservation of the world's forests and the possibility of having a less devastating production. The success of the non-governmental environmental organizations in the United States shouldn't be the loss of the indigenous Mexicans. This is the ethical problem that's in the background.
Some Mexican authorities estimate that more than half of their country's wood is cut without the proper authorization. This illicit business was one impetus for the passage of Mexico's 1997 forestry law. Officials say the law will help curb the contraband by empowering the environmental attorney general to demand permits from truckers hauling logs. Engineer Leonel Iglesias is responsible for coordinating the government's National Institute of Forestry Research in northern Mexico.
Uno es el artículo 20 de la ley forestal que se modificó.
Article 20 of the forest law was modified and is now facilitating the control of wood transportation on the highways by means of a required documentation. Under previous modifications of the law in 1994, transporters weren't required to have documentation to show the authorities. Now, with the modifications of the law on May 20th of 1997, transporters are once again required to have documentation. The document will have to disclose the origin and destination of the wood and the forest plot, not only ejido, from where it came. Also, the wood will have to be marked in some way.
The big question will be enforcement of the new law. In many instances, government offices are located hours away from the logging areas, and personnel are not regularly stationed in the mountains. According to Iglesias, Mexico's environmental attorney general is in the process of forming volunteer civilian committees to monitor wood shipments. But some representatives of landowners' groups in Chihuahua and Guerrero say the timber vigilante committees have been slow to start up. Meanwhile, Mexican timber and wood products continue arriving in the United States. Everything from ponderosa pine logs to toothpicks to sawn mahogany. Commodities are even entering the country in such unlikely places as Mobile, Alabama and Buffalo, New York. I'm Kent Patterson reporting.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're talking about property rights and the movement to change our laws so interests of property owners receive higher priority. Disputes about where private property interests end and community interests begin have been prevalent through the development of our laws concerning the environment. For example, some property owners say that laws that stop them from filling in a wetland violate their private property rights. Others who defend the community interests say filling in the wetland may cause flooding of downstream property. Therefore, it's reasonable to restrict the private property owner to protect the interests of the neighbor as well as the entire community. So the question is, do our environmental laws restrict private property rights unfairly? I have two experts with me who see the issues somewhat differently. One is John Echevarria. He's an environmental law professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. He has litigated and written about this issue for many years on behalf of environmental causes. Also with us is Grant Mazden, and he is the Director of Communications for Defenders of Property Rights, also in Washington. So, Grant, let's start with you. What's wrong with restricting private property rights to protect the entire community?
Well, it's a good question, and it depends not just whether the regulation itself. Well, there are two issues that maybe to be addressed. One is whether the regulation itself goes too far and acts in a way that is denies all property rights for the property owner, and the other one is how it's actually implemented. So, in the example you said at the very beginning, it may not, in fact, violate a property right per se when the government precludes someone from filling in a wetland, but the way it is implemented may, in fact, violate the person's right, and especially in the sense that, in many cases, that could deny the property owner all useful or productive use of the land, and that, in fact, would be, according to the Supreme Court, a taking of the land, in which case, here, the community shouldn't be prevented from doing protecting itself, but it should, in fact, pay compensation. And if the community refuses to pay compensation, that would be unconstitutional. But if it does, in fact, pay restitution, then it would be constitutional.
And this, I guess, is where the real rub comes out. John Echevarria from Georgetown, you have struggled, and I know lobbied hard in the Congress about proposals which would require the government to pay compensation to private property owners that I know that you believe has been much too extreme. What has that been all about?
Congress has considered a variety of legislative proposals, all of which are designed to create a fast track to the courts for developers seeking to get the public to pay them not to do what they want with their property. I'm happy to report that, to date at least, Congress has uniformly rejected all those proposals. And we like to say that the more people understand the takings of property rights issue, the less they like it. Grant started off by saying that this whole issue doesn't have to do with whether the government can do anything, but whether or not it has to pay as a condition doing that. And it seems to me that's a real red herring, because if you have to pay in order to carry out a public objective, it's obviously going to be a lot harder to do that. And the proponents of this legislation know certainly well that if we have to pay to preserve our communities, it's going to be a lot harder to do that.
Grant, do you believe that there should be much more payment going on now to bring about those or implement those laws that we now have in the books that protect the environment?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that maybe in the words of Oliver Wendell Holmes, that there's no disputing that a lot of the environmental legislation that is on the books has noble objectives. The question is, though, whether it's, in many cases, we haven't taken a constitutional or a shortcut that in a way goes against the Constitution. And so I think that the only fair thing to do is to pay people when, in fact, their property has been, for all intents and purposes, taken from them. Not to do so would be unconstitutional. Now, in fact, I think John has a good point, and that is it may make certain regulations more difficult, and that needs to be weighed in the consideration of all these bills. But in the long run, we think that it's probably better to follow the Constitution stringently and let that be the top priority, and everything else sort of follows after that.
Well, before we get into the Constitution, Grant, let me ask you a question. For many years, I lived in an apartment house in New York City. It was a cooperative, which meant that all the owners owned it. There was a zoning change which said that the apartment house couldn't go any higher than it was at the time, which was 15 stories. So, in effect, the owners lost the opportunity to go from 15 stories to, say, 40. Should we have been paid when they made that zoning change?
Not necessarily, and that gets into the specifics of that, of your situation, and what sort of understanding existed at the time when the property was purchased, and those sorts of things. It's not the point is not that government can't regulate and that zoning can't take place, and so on. At issue is, and the court has created several standards by which to judge whether a taking has in fact taken place, And there, it's a series of tests. And I think that in general terms, without going through all the very specifics of zoning and environmental regulation and historic preservation and so on, I think that in general terms, the way our organization feels is that we probably ought to make it easier for property owners to, in fact, get access to the courts to, in fact, get compensation when the court feels that a violation of the Constitution has taken place and so on.
So, John Echevarria, how do you line up on that? What I hear Grant saying is, sounds like more litigation to me.
Well, I think the legislation, his group proposals, would lead to more litigation. I think that the key here is to find a balance, and the starting place in getting to a balanced result is to recognize that there are tens of millions of property owners in this country, and some of them are developers, and some of them are other kinds of landowners, but the overwhelming majority of landowners in this country are homeowners. There's 65 million homeowners, and I don't know about the two of you, but my largest single asset is my family home. And I have a strong interest in property rights, and I certainly want to protect the value of my investment in my home like every other homeowner. But that depends on enforcing reasonable regulations that protect the quality of the environment, that prevent somebody upwind, upslope, upriver from me from doing something that adversely affects the quality of my environment. I think of Patrice Butterfield, a woman from Statesboro, Georgia, who bought a home in a subdivision. When she bought it, she was assured by the developer that the wetlands behind the property, the cypress swamp behind her property, was protected by the Clean Water Act, and therefore it wasn't going to be destroyed. She paid a price that reflected the fact that she had that land behind her. Well, a couple of years later, the developer went ahead and filled in the property, in fact, did so illegally, with the result that her property was then flooded. And I think people like Patrice Butterfield deserve the protection of their property rights just as much as any other property owner. And what's necessary is a mechanism to achieve a balance. And that's what we have in this country. And groups like Defenders of Property Rights, in my view, really aren't out for the best interests of most property owners, but instead are promoting the interests of a very narrow set of property owners, primarily developers, who don't have the best interests of existing homeowners at heart.
Grant, what about that? Doesn't homeowner need the kind of protection that John is talking about?
Yeah, I think that he's actually, there are two things that I sort of have to address that he said. The first is, I couldn't agree more that the individual homeowner is the kind of person who is most affected by this sort of thing. And I'd like to tell sort of a story of Bob and Mary McMack and a couple that we represented who, very similar to the people that John talked about, bought a home up in the Poconos, followed all the rules, applied for all the permits, got everything. Everything was fine. And 4 years after they'd moved into, they built their home, they'd moved in, lived there for a couple of years, and suddenly they get a letter in the mail that says essentially cease and desist. Your land has been deemed a wetland, and we need you to stop, you know, mowing your lawn and doing all the other things that a homeowner does. And you know, those are the kinds. You know, that's maybe a situation that's more pertinent to what our group does, so that I think that he's not quite, I mean, I feel like I can better say the kind of or people we represent, and this is the kind of person we represent. I don't think it's specifically developers or so on. I think it's homeowners.
Let me ask you about that particular instance. If it were determined that by doing things on that wetland, those folk were then putting in danger the folk downstream, isn't it appropriate to bring regulations to bear with respect to their
absolutely
property?
See, yeah, that's exactly the point I've been trying to make.
But aren't you saying that they need to be paid not to damage the guy downstream?
Well, to a certain extent, in the sense that it's not just the guy downstream, it's the public at large that is benefiting. And I think the courts have been fairly clear that you can't single out individuals or small groups to pay solely for what benefits the public at large. And so in that sense, yeah, I think that some sort of compensation, or, you know, if we could come up with a even a policy solution that allowed people to work together rather than simply saying, you know, too bad you happen to live on a wetland, you lose all value of your land and everybody else benefits. You know, instead of having to always go that approach and instead come up with different ways of mitigating or allowing for some sort of negotiation, I think that that would be a vast improvement over the essentially coercive methods that have been used up to date.
John Echevarria, having everybody sit around the table and agreeing and living happily ever after sounds reasonable. Why isn't it happening?
That's our goal, and I think that the takings proposal actually interferes with that. That the choice here, it seems to me, is between having the city council, having the selectmen sit down and work out the kinds of rules and regulations the community needs to live by. the Constitution has a takings clause, it has a Fifth Amendment, but also starts out, we the people. And the notion is that through the democratic process, we the people are permitted to establish rules that protect our communities. And my concern is that the whole takings agenda basically says that we can, as a community, sit down and declare that we need greater protection for our wetlands. We need greater protection for the historic districts in our communities. We need to be able to put a limitation on the height of Peter Burley's apartment building. It seems to me that is what our government process is all about, and that's entirely legitimate, and it's consistent with democratic values. The choice is between having developers use the courts to manage our communities or to have our elected representatives manage our communities. And I'm not sure either one is entirely ideal, but I'd much rather put my confidence in our elected representatives than in outside developers.
Let me ask you both something. We have been discussing this in very specific terms as it relates to the homeowner, but indeed there has been a series of bills, in fact one that wound up at the end of the last session of Congress, that in effect would put a lot of these issues into the courts more rapidly. In a society that worries about whether it's getting over litigious, are we about to become even more so? Grant, what do you think?
I think it's a good question. I think it's a good question worth considering. I think that maybe in general terms, and I can pick up where John left off, you know, it's not quite so simple as communities versus rich developers. And these particular bills you're talking about address specifically that point, which is if you are a small homeowner, you know, the kind of people that make up the vast majority of private property owners, you want to have a speedier court process in case there is conflict, because you don't have the money to spend to see a lot of these issues through all of the loops and things you have to go through in order to finally get a resolution of your dispute. And so I think the vast majority of the motivation behind the kinds of legislative initiatives we're seeing right now is sparked by the fact that individuals who don't have deep pockets are finding it essentially impossible to ever come to a resolution.
Okay, I'm going to ask John to sum up quickly because our time is almost up.
Well, the legislation that you're referring to was written for, by, and on behalf of the development community. Homeowners don't need, people who want to buy homes, who want to use small pieces of property, don't need more litigation opportunities. What they need is reasonable governmental procedures, and this takings agenda is not a way to achieve that.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both. We've been discussing private property rights and the environment. We've been talking green. We want to know what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And my guests have been John Echevarria, who is an environmental law professor at Georgetown, and Grant Mazin, who is Director of Communications for Defenders of Property Rights. Again, we've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. We're going to be talking green about wolves and their reintroduction. If you want to participate, call 1-888-49-GREEN and leave us your phone number. You can also reach us by email anytime. It's green@wamc.org. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author David Noland, it's experiencing the day-to-day life along an active river in Borneo. In this portrait, Noland reads a passage from his book titled Travels Along the Edge, 40 Ultimate Adventures for the Modern Nomad, from crossing the Sahara to bicycling through Vietnam.
Borneo is a place where you can gaze into the eyes of an orangutan, climb the highest mountain in Southeast Asia, crouch beside a sea turtle while she lays her eggs in the sand, or sniff the stench of 2 million bats in a cave the size of a blimp hangar. But to know the heart and soul of Borneo, you must make a journey by riverboat. Roads are strictly a coastal phenomenon on this island of mountains and jungle. The mere motorist can only nibble around the edges. To the people of the interior, it is the rivers that are the lifelines of commerce and society. In the heart of Borneo, there was no north and south, no east and west. There was only upriver and downriver. We traveled in a motorized longboat, only one evolutionary step above a hollowed-out log. Long as a stretched limo, it was just wide enough to accept one set of 50th percentile American buttocks. We sat on the floor like a six-man bobsled team as the water rushed by our elbows. There was a crew of two. The bowman stood at the front, signaling the helmsman the bearing and distance of onrushing rocks and logs. Just in case, he carried a bamboo pole to fend them off. The skipper stood in the stern, scanning the river ahead and jockeying the throttle of a 30-horsepower Yamaha outboard. In shallow water, the helmsman employed a rather odd procedure. Over and over, he rammed the throttle back and forth between idle and full throttle every 2 or 3 seconds. It made for a jerky, annoying ride and, it seemed to me, wasted a lot of fuel. And these guys didn't look like they could afford to waste much fuel. Turns out, of course, there was a very good reason for all this throttle jockeying. In the shallow, rocky waters this far upstream, propeller repair costs happened to be the major operating expense. If we hit a rock, there was a 50-50 chance that the propeller would be idling at the moment of impact and would therefore not break off. Propeller repair costs are thus cut by half. In addition to their canny economic sense, the Borneo rivermen have a remarkable resourcefulness. We saw an example of this one evening while lounging on the riverbank in the small river town of Mulu, a bit further downstream. Two young men, hooting and hollering in youthful exuberance, sped past in a longboat much like ours. Crossing another boat's wake, the driver made a sudden swerve just for the hell of it. The maneuver caused the insufficiently attached outboard motor to fly off the stern and disappear in a geyser of spray. The engineless craft, propelled only by its momentum, continued to glide down the river in utter silence, a silence that was broken by the convulsive laughter of village onlookers even before the boat had stopped. A modern-day American suffering such a mishap would have paddled ashore and immediately called his insurance agent, and perhaps his lawyer, in order to sue the outboard manufacturer for the defective design of the motor mount. But things worked differently in Borneo. Within 2 or 3 minutes, a half dozen longboats and 25 excited men and boys had converged on the spot where the motor had disappeared. They began diving overboard in the muddy 15-foot deep water, each keen to be the first to find the sunken treasure. Within 10 minutes, the motor had been located, hauled up with a rope, and taken ashore. 20 minutes after that, the same two young men sped by in the same boat, its resuscitated motor humming smoothly at full throttle. As they disappeared around the bend, they were hooting and hollering still.
That was author David Noland reading from his book, Travels Along the Edge, 40 Ultimate Adventures for the Modern Nomad, from crossing the Sahara to bicycling through Vietnam. It's published by Vintage Books. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If you want to make soup out of brown algae, you need a copy of the tape. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and order show number 419. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer. Producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Funding for coverage of the Mexico Forest is provided by the Fund for Investigative Journalism and the KUNM Producers Fund. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.